Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Right here in the studio, I have Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol, who have their first album in 7 years, Wildness, coming out May 25th. And we've already heard a couple songs from it. I got to hear the whole album, and it feels like a real step forward for you guys. I really enjoyed it. It's also extremely emotionally turbulent, I would say.
Yeah, I think the genesis of the songs comes from some turbulence, for sure, but I like to think that there's a lot of hope in the record too. For sure, there's a lot of positive stuff in there, but yeah, the genesis of the songs comes from some tough times.
I think part of what you're doing right now and going around and talking about this record, I was thinking about it, whenever a record comes from personal turbulence, personal difficulties, it ends up being this thing like, oh God, am I going to have to talk about all this personal turbulence every single time? Luckily, we're at the near to the beginning of your talking about this every single time, but I do think about that. That must be a weird thing.
I think if I learned anything from my...
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Experiences with the record, with the issues that maybe founded the record, I learned that talking about it is the best possible thing to do. So it's actually good to keep talking about it in a way. But I there'll also be days when I don't want to. And that today's not one of those days. I'll talk about anything you want, but you know, those days haven't come yet, so we'll see.
But let's hear Life on Earth. Was that the one that you said in the show took you 5 years to write? Was that from
not every day, but from start to finish. I wrote the chorus first, and that came pretty easily. I guess it's a kind of a universal, expansive chorus, and but then the verse. I couldn't figure out a melody to begin with that I felt complemented the chorus, or at least ran up to the chorus, and I wanted two melodies. And then once I got the melody, trying to get the words right. Life on Earth is, it's a rather wide subject matter, so trying to retrofit it was very tricky. So it did take a long, long time. There is books and books and books of writing all on that, and I would say 99% of it is garbage. So I'm going to definitely go home and make sure that those go in the shredder.
Is that your usual approach? That's the sort of Leonard Cohen approach to songwriting, where you just write and write and write verses, or Springsteen used to do that too. There's people who do that.
That wouldn't be my usual approach. I don't know what that says about my writing in the past, but I've always felt a little bit that things have come quicker. Certainly a lot quicker than 7 years, but I never really had a problem writing. I think it was because I was trying to write about different things this time. You know, I hadn't been in a relationship in a long time. A lot of the stuff that I'd done in the past was maybe based around relationships, you know, perhaps going through some tough times. But I hadn't even been in a relationship in 8 years, or up to this point, I haven't been in a relationship in 8 years. So to write about that would be fraud in the extreme. So I wanted to write about something that was actually happening to me right that moment. So I think that's why it took so long, because I hadn't figured out how to do that yet.
Let's hear Life on Earth. Ultimately, what are you grappling with that song? And I really love the drama of it, and you can kind of feel some high emotional stakes going on in it. Those stabbing guitar things, and it's like, yeah, it's a lot going on there.
Yeah. Well, I think when the drums entered that track for the first time, I was like, "Hang on a minute, what's going on here? This is something. This is something new. This is something else. The song kind of is prophesizes itself in a way." And what's going on in it? I guess I ended up trying to write a song about a part of my life, and ended up writing a song about all of my life. And every line in the verse is a different sort of time in my life, from the very first story my mum ever told about me, which was when I was a baby. And there was the biggest snowdrift in Northern Ireland of all time, still to this date. And it was literally the height of me. But I don't know how my mum knew that, unless she actually took me outside and plonked me down in it. But I'm hoping that wasn't what happened. But, you know, the 70s were a different time. So maybe... and then, you know, first dance, first kiss, first everything, all the way through to, you know, being more reflective in more recent years.
And I think you got Wildness, the album title, from a line in that song, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Ancient Wildness. The album was almost going to be called Ancient Wildness, and then Garrett, also known as Jackknife Lee, said, "Sounds a bit like Enya to me." And well, there's nothing wrong with Enya, but I think his point was that it's a little new agey or something. Wildness made a hell of a lot more sense, and that Wildness actually features in the song Heal Me as well, so it does sort of permeate the record.
And this sort of the depression you've talked about going through, because that's when I heard the line, you know, shouldn't be so fucking hard, I'm like, well, yeah, and it shouldn't be, but it is, often is, for a lot of people.
Yeah, and a hell of a lot of people have it a hell of a lot worse than I ever did, and you know, I've at least I can you know, there are many things in my life that have gone extraordinarily right, and I'm very grateful for them. But I also, one of the main things is that I get to write about it, and a lot of people don't have that outlet. They don't have an outlet that actually gives them a place where they can find a way out of the darkness that they're in, and that's been the most helpful for me. Even when I'm banging my head against the wall trying to come up with the lines and words, it's still better than just sitting in the dark staring into the abyss. You know, I'd struggled with depression since I was a teenager. Grew up in Northern Ireland at a time when the most usual question on the street was, are you Protestant or Catholic? And I didn't see myself as either. And I didn't understand why everybody was... I mean, I was raised in a Protestant faith, an Anglican faith, but I didn't... I never really was that connected to it, and I'm certainly not now. And it really confused me as a kid why everyone was hating on each other and fighting and dying and killing each other. It didn't make any sense. And I think growing up in that environment made me feel very isolated. I didn't realize at the time that there were a lot of kids feeling exactly the same thing. And the generation that I came from was the first generation that actually moved towards peace. And now we have peace, and it's a different place. Northern Ireland, you know, I have a place there. I've moved home. I love it there. It's become, you know, a big part of my heart in a way that I was trying to, you know, the same way that I run toward it now, it was I was running just as fast away from it as a kid. And I think it affected me deeply. And that's what I was sort of struggling with, that alienation, isolation, that sort of followed me around until I dealt with it in more recent times.
Even your previous album, you actually spoke of a bout of writer's block.
Yeah. Yeah, writer's block is one thing, but this wasn't particularly writer's block, in that writer's block, you tend to have a subject matter, and then you maybe don't know how to write about that subject matter. I didn't even have any subject matters at the time. I think that was just trying to figure out what to write about was the first thing. And once I knew that I wanted to be, I mean, I was always honest in my lyrics, but like, you know, brutally honest about my mind, about my family. But what my dad was going through, about my alcoholism, all of these things, when you start to list them, they make it sound like the record is very depressing, but it's really not. Because, you know, I definitely see the light in all of these things. You know, even in the song about my father's dementia, it's created a powerful bond between us that we perhaps, I mean, we've always had a bond, but maybe not as strong as we have now. We actually made a video for that song where him and I watch old home movies together. And
wow.
And it is, when I explain it to people, they think, oh, that must be really like sad or you know, like, you know, you're bound to be crying during. I find myself laughing so much during it because my dad's hilarious. The videos, the home movies are hilarious. There are moments when you're, you know, you're deep. I was touched, and a lot of people are touched by it as well. But it's not a sad video. It's an extremely happy video, I think. And it really sort of turned the song kind of into this positive light for me. And I'm getting to spend the day with my dad filming on set, where he would forget sometimes where we were. And he would turn around and go, what are we doing here again? And then other times I'd be like mid singing. I'd sung through most of the takes. He would sort of interrupt me. I'd go, this is great, isn't it? And I would just be laughing, and those shots have actually been incorporated into the video where I'm laughing, and it was a really beautiful day.
You way before this record, you've talked of like at least attempts at quitting drinking. I don't know if that was to an extent where you thought you were an alcoholic, or you just thought you were drinking too much, because there's a difference, obviously.
Well, there's a big difference between alcoholism, depending on where you're from in the world. You know, I'm an American alcoholic. I'm an Irish drinker. You know, this is it's a big, big difference. I don't think there are any official alcoholics in Ireland. We just drink a lot. You either drink or you don't, and you probably drink, or at least you used to. And you know that. And it wasn't. I got to a stage with drinking where it wasn't fun anymore. It was creating too many problems for me in my health, and also in my mind. You know, like I would go out and get drunk every day, and sometimes just by myself. I'd just be sitting in a bar by myself drinking, and I'd always promised myself that I would never do that, that I would never drink alone.
Were you ever writing songs using alcohol to kind of like loosen up the creative processes?
I never wrote a song drunk in my life, which is a lot of the reason why it took 7 years to make this record, because for the first five of them, I was hammered. And then, you know, 2 years ago, I quit. And, you know, lo and behold, I mean, as if by magic, we started working almost in earnest with gusto.
What was the first seed to start this record?
Life on Earth was the first thing written. As I say, you know, 5 years ago, the chorus was written. But the first thing, and then I spent a long time kind of writing songs, not being happy with them, feeling like I was getting nowhere, getting very depressed. Garrett and I went through a lot of tense moments in our lives where, you know, he'd be sort of pushing to create and I would be resistant to it. I think it'd be really interesting interview if, you know, he speaks very candidly, but to get his perspective on the record as well, because I'm sure he was tearing his hair out at times with me and my resistance. And it was, you know, it was more personal resistance to anything. I think I enjoyed living, you know, spent a lot of time in LA, and I was, the sunshine is good for your mind, but it's not as good for your creativity, I don't think. I think that's why so many bands come from Ireland and Scotland, because it rains all the time and everyone has to stay indoors. But the first song we wrote was Don't Give In all the way through. That was finished probably, I don't even know, 2014. So that was the first sort of indicator that, oh, okay, hang on a minute, something could be done here, and we could definitely get a record. I can definitely still write a song.
That's a scary feeling, to feel like you might not be able to still write a song.
Yeah, I read this thing. I read this thing by Henry Rollins, who is, you know, I'm a big fan of. Actually, my first gig that I ever went to was Red Hot Chili Peppers, supported by the Rollins Band in the Ulster Hall in Belfast in 1991, and Rollins just blew me away. I've been a fan ever since. I went to see the Chili's and loved them, but properly fell in love with Henry Rollins. And he said this amongst his many gems. He said, when asked why he doesn't make music anymore, he says, I've had my time. I've had my music. It's used up. You get a certain amount and then you don't get any more. And I thought, oh shit, I've had my music, it's used up. This is speaking from a man that I respect, a man that I have been a fan of for years and years. Why would he lie to me? And, you know, he's not lying. This is his own truth. That's what he's saying. But, you know, I've come to realize that if he is true, and I'm sure there's truth in it, I haven't used my music up yet. Thank God.
Let's hear Don't Give In. Don't give in. No, you dare quit so easy. Give on. Yeah, I was going to ask you who you're talking to on that song.
Well, initially it was a friend of mine who had been going through something pretty severe and had tried to take his own life. And it was just a simple message to him. And as I was writing, I realized that maybe I hadn't been so far from those thoughts in my life at times. And it started to become, it was always about him, but it also became about me. And then it became about the record itself, where it was like, so many times I thought, I can't do this, as I've already, touched on. And, you know, it became a kind of a torch to kind of follow, and like, so, just literally telling myself not to give in.
So even after you wrote that song, it wasn't like the clouds parted. There was still struggle. How did that take place?
So then I went into another period of... I was still drinking at the time. And I went into another period of kind of the dark ages where, you know, things didn't come as easy. Mm. And I was struggling. And it was really only after I quit drinking that, you know, things... about 6 months after that, I think you need about 6 months to sort of clear everything out. I mean, things are still clearing out. It might take years, but it, you know, gives you that initial spring cleaning to give you enough clarity and sort of perspective to make another kind of go at it. And we were in the studio. I'd written a bunch of songs, but just didn't have any lyrics. And a song called High Pop at the time. I'd name songs silly things when I'm just to remember what they are. We'd started recording it. Myself and Jackknife and Nathan Connolly, our guitar player, were in the studio that day, and we'd pretty much recorded it. And I was listening around to it. I was sitting at the desk, Garrett's chair, which I don't normally do. Sitting in the big boy chair, and I was writing, mostly gibberish. And then Garrett, a lot of times during the day, will put his whole studio was just vinyl all the way around the walls, and it isn't for display. You know, he knows where everything is. He pulls out, you know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of records, and he pulls out things, and we play records during the day, and we were listening to a lot of different stuff. Peter Gabriel was a big one during this record, a lot of African stuff, Fela Kuti, William Onyebar, listening to a lot of soul music. The Staple Singers Mavis Staples was all over this record. And then he brought out Nick Cave's most recent album. It was fairly new at the time. And the first track on that is Jesus Alone. And he put that on. And I kind of went into a trance. I mean, the record is about, you know, something extraordinarily tragic that happened in Nick Cave's life. And it just profoundly went into bass. If you know that song, like, has a vibration in it that just rattles your bones, it rattles your soul, and it started to kind of like jar things loose in me, like in my psyche. And we listened to it 10 times in a row. I kept saying, just put it on again, just put it on again, something's happening. And then he put it on again, and I started to write. And then Garrett went, me and Nathan are just going to pop out, we'll get a sandwich, and we'll come back in half an hour. This is the sign of a, like, not just a great producer, but one of the best to ever do it, is to know when to push and to know when to get the fuck out of the room. Because in the half an hour that it took them to go and get a sandwich, I wrote the song, every word, in a oneer. And that song was Youth Written Fire. High pop became Youth Written Fire, thank God. And it was about, you know, my alcoholism, whatever was going on in the fabric of the song, Nick Cave's song. It was telling me to go deep into my soul, and I wrote a song about just, I guess, my younger days of elasticity, and watching many sunrises through the tattered curtains of student flats, and to my more recent days when it just wasn't fun anymore. That song changed everything, because I started to write it with abandon then.
Let's actually hear that Nick Cave song.
With my voice, I am calling you.
You know, one of the things that was going on is you have a member of the band, Johnny, who's out writing with Ed Sheeran and doing all sorts of things. How does that interact on a practical level with just trying to get Snow Patrol work done?
Johnny does all his writing with other people when we're not in the studio or we're not on tour. You know what I mean? There's never been a point where Johnny's went, you guys have to wait. You know, he's made his priority us. We didn't demand that of him. He's given that of himself. I mean, he is very in demand at the moment. And I can't imagine what his inbox looks like these days. It must be piling up with people clamoring to work with him, but he's not letting on anyway.
He doesn't really work on the actual songwriting with you, does he?
We wrote Empress together. Jackknife, me and him wrote Empress together, and the music for Empress. And there were some other songs we wrote, maybe 10 or 15 songs together. They just didn't make the record this time. But I would imagine in the future that the songs that we write together will start to.
Are you surprised that this, like, Shape of You style stuff has been in him the whole time? Is he that kind of does he seem like a Mr. Pop upon first inspection?
Well, I mean, he's been producing, co-writing with people for so many years, you know. I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with some people as well, especially Ed, so I know what that feels like, and Ed is a joy to work with, you know. But it's sometimes it's I've lucked out and had great sessions with Taylor Swift and One Direction and Ed Sheeran, but there's other ones that, you know, maybe I don't talk about so much that, you know, they're kind of like pulling teeth, you know, like you're in the room with someone and they don't know what to write about, and I always feel like, well, if you don't know, then I don't want to go, well, here's what I think you should write about, you know. It's like, I think it should come from the person whose name is on the record, you know. So I can't imagine what he goes through. He never lets on that he's had a terrible time in the studio. He's always really positive about everybody. But I would imagine there'd be some times in his life where he's thinking what I was thinking in some of those sessions.
Yeah, with Taylor Swift, you had a song on the Red album last time.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
It was great. It was so fast. She works really fast. She's extraordinary, actually. We did that song, wrote it and recorded it in a day, and that was the version that went on the record, which is very rare. That's very rare. Normally you write and record something with somebody, and then down the line they'll record it, maybe, if you're lucky. Well, with her, the whole thing was done in 9 hours, I think.
We never miss a chance to play Taylor Swift. Let's hear Gary with Taylor Swift on Last Time.
Awesome.
Has it been weird for you to watch? That was the kind of the last time I interviewed her, was around that time, and she's become like Taylor Swift in all capital letters. At that time, she was Taylor Swift, like slightly smaller capital letters.
Yeah, she's the biggest star in the world. I'm she's an extraordinary talent. I can't speak more highly of her. She's it was amazing to work with her. I hope we can do it again sometime. I'm not pitching. Taylor, it's up to you.
Hey, and obviously you have your own working relationship with Ed Sheeran. You guys, what is the nature of the Snow Patrol Ed Sheeran kind of bond?
So when Ed was touring the Plus album, his first album, and we were playing the same festival in Switzerland. It was a radio festival for Energy, and we. Like, his dressing room was down the hall from ours. Well, first of all, on the plane on the way there from London, I was sitting in my seat, being the good boy that turns up early, and Ed walked in on the plane, and we both looked at each other as if to say, I know you. And he looked at me to say, I know you. But we didn't say anything. And when I got to the arena, I wrote a letter, and I left it in his dressing room. It's very abusive. No, I said I was a big fan, and that, you know, it'd be great to hang out, you know, if you wanted to. And I went back to the hotel after sound check, and when I got back, our tour manager, who's sitting over there in the corner, Mr. Neil Mather, said that Ed had popped into the dressing room and said he'd love to hang out. And we went out that night and had a great laugh, really great laugh, and we kind of bonded. Our initial bond was. Ed wasn't completely covered in tattoos at that point, but he had a few, and I was admiring his tattoos, and I said, the only tattoo I've ever thought of getting was a lyric by Bon Iver, and Ed, without missing a beat, said, everything that happens is from now on, and I went, holy shit, did you just read my mind? He's like, no, I wanted that too.
Whoa.
I'm like, so we both wanted the same lyric by the same artist tattooed on our arms, and I thought, yeah, this guy, we're gonna be pals, and we have been ever since. And you know, I've worked with Ed a lot, and I've worked with him recently actually, he is by far has more ideas than anybody else that I've ever known. He is an ideas machine. It's just constant energy. Constant. I mean, he writes 10, 15 songs in a go, you know what I mean? He's not, I don't think he's ever, he even understands the concept of writer's block. It's, it's an extraordinary thing to watch. It's, he's a massive talent, massive.
The way the pop world is now, it's kind of a world of people like Ed and who are very sort of genre agnostic or, you know, or certainly not tied to rock, and just as you sit down and, you know, as if it isn't hard enough to make the album, like how do you factor into your thinking, like, God, this is the way the world is now, it's not super friendly to rock bands in some way?
I think maybe the way music is found by people, disseminated, isn't super friendly. You know, the album isn't king anymore, but it still is king or prince, at the very least, to a lot of people. Yeah. There are a lot of people out there that still love to listen to albums. There are a lot of people out there, like myself, and I think you'll find them eventually. I don't think that it's a lost cause by any means. And also, this is the environment that we have to work in. The song is now king, and that's I almost rhymed there. I was going to say that's no bad thing, but I'm gonna retrace my steps on that one. I think that there is a hell of a lot of great songs out there, and we want to bring out our best songs and be part of it. I don't think we should be afraid of it. Just because things have changed in the last 7 years, because they were always going to change.
How did you end up on Game of Thrones? And I actually we should play your little singing cameo on Game of Thrones.
My filthy song?
One of your biggest hits, no doubt.
Yes.
He lifted her high in the air. He sniffed and roared and smelled her there. She kicked and wailed, the maid so fair. But he licked the honey from her hair. From there to here, from here to there, all black and brown and covered with hair. He smelled that girl in the summer air, the bear, and the maiden fair.
Pretty funny. And also, did you write that little ditty? Or?
No, it's in the book. It's in the third. It's in the third book.
But did the tune at least?
No, that was the music the guy that writes the score, the guy that writes the extraordinary music in Game of Thrones, the theme music and all that. He wrote the tune, and I had to sing it on horseback.
Yeah.
And well, first of all, I had to learn how to ride a horse because I'd never ridden a horse before. But I'd watched the. I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary Buck.
No.
It's on Netflix. It's the most extraordinary documentary you'll ever see in your life. I would say to people, to whatever you're doing, as long as it's not operating heavy machinery, stop doing it and watch Buck. It's the most extraordinary documentary. It's about the guy that the movie The Horse Whisperer was based on, and this guy Buck Buchanan, and he basically changed the way people break horses. You know, they break them gently now, and basically stopped it, cut out the brutality that was involved in, you know, the term breaking horses comes from, you know, a very real thing what they used to do with all kinds of medieval equipment, even up until the, you know, the 50s and 60s, and probably even later. And anyway, I'd watched the documentary so many times, 10, 12 times, and I thought, well, I know horses. That's how naive I was. I know horses. My horse and me are going to be pals immediately because I know Buck. And I got to the. You had to do a day horse training before I filmed. It's all shot in Northern Ireland, which is very. You know, all the places I had to go to film and to train with the horses were 15 minutes from my house. And so I went over and I met my horse. And I knew immediately this horse fucking hated me. And it went on like that for the whole day. He wouldn't do anything for me. He wouldn't do any, he wouldn't move. On, I was like, sort of like clicking my heels, moving the reins. I was talking to him in his ear. Come on, buddy, we can do this. But that horse would not, he was not for moving. And luckily, on the day of the filming, I was in a procession of horses, so the horse just had to follow the horse in front of it, or he would not have moved. I feel really deeply hurt by that still today.
But I did want to take a look back for a minute, because I saw you guys at a very small club, and a couple things struck me. I mean, you seem to be really having a good time, and I think some of that maybe is just like after an album that was very hard to make, it must be very satisfying to get on stage and be able to play the old stuff, play the new stuff, and see the fans react. That's what I guess.
Yeah, I felt the weight of everything that I've been feeling just fall away during that gig. From the minute I walked on stage to the end of it, I had a absolute ball. We played in London a week, maybe slightly more than a week ago, and the same thing happened. I just felt this overwhelming joy. I think that's what you need to do. You don't need to do, I can't speak for anybody else, but that's what I need to do, is to separate the album from the live. Because if I carried what I went through making the album with me everywhere, I, you know, like I wouldn't be able to last a few months on tour. So I think tour is for having fun. Tour is for trying to, you know, have fun with the audience. Make sure the audience have a good time. It's important to me that people walk away from our shows having had fun.
What was cool is, you know, songs like Run and Chasing Cars, to see that little audience singing it back to you, I could tell you were really vibing on that and really enjoying it. But then I was also thinking, like, you've also seen, you know, huge festivals sing that at you. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to mean possibly just as much, which was interesting to me.
It always means the same to me. It means it means more than I can possibly ever. I wrote, especially Run, I wrote that song when I had nothing, you know. I had the electricity had just gone off in the house, and I'd like to think it didn't have anything to do with the line "light up, light up," but it probably did subconsciously. We had nothing. We were living in friends, sleeping on friends' couches. We were sleeping on the back of our equipment in the van. We were asking, when we were playing gigs to 20, 30 people, we were asking the audience about three songs from the end if we could sleep on their, you know, somebody's living room floor. and somebody would always say yes.
Yeah.
And we met a lot of great people doing that.
That was very Henry Rollins of you, actually. That was, you know.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that kind of punk ethic kind of informed a lot of our early sort of days. The first 10 years was very punk, because everything was kind of fixed together with safety pins. You know, it was everything, all our lives, our minds, our hearts, our equipment, our clothes, everything was sort of very close to falling apart at any minute. And, you know, we went through 10 years of in obscurity. Obviously, we weren't in obscurity. We were living in our own heads and lives, but we were also shouting into a void in a lot of ways. And and Run came along at a time when I think we were all, certainly our parents and our close friends, were probably saying, that's probably it now. That's plenty. You know, you should probably get a job. You should definitely.
I like that's plenty as an assessment of your career up
until. Yeah. You need to rest now, or at least work somewhere else. You know, and then we released the album Final Straw, which would go on to sell millions of records. But at the time, for the first 6 months, it sold the same amount as the first two albums, which is about 7,000 copies. And then Joe Wiley, who was a Radio 1 DJ, BBC Radio 1 DJ at home, and now she was on BBC Radio 2. She had a daytime show, and she played Run, the album version, which was 6 minutes long, a song that we hadn't up to that point thought to make a radio edit of. She played all 6 minutes of it in daytime radio, and the phone lines melted, and it changed our lives forever. So that piece of luck changed everything. And so that song, even more than Chasing Cars, although that means a lot to me too, means the world to me.
Well, let's hear Run. And not to beat it to death, but besides the lights going out, what do you remember about the actual writing?
I was in my bedroom. There are no pictures on the walls. They're bare. There are clothes, towels on the floor. It is a student accommodation, even though I have not been a student in 7 years. The lights are off. It's candlelight because there's no electricity. It's freezing cold. My guitar has stickers all over it. Those are the things I remember.
That's interesting. It's not how you wrote it, but you remember the...
I remember exactly everything about it. And I don't remember that for every song I've ever written. I remember the chorus happening for the first time and feeling something. There's a line in one of my favorite books, Grab Onto Me Tightly As If I Know the Way, that the central character, Vim Sweeney, is speaking to a girl that he realizing that he's falling in love with, but has only just met, and he says, something is happening here. And that line floored me at the time and always floors me when I think about it, and that's what I felt.
We should also talk about Chasing Cars, even if that doesn't have quite as much personal resonance for you. Let's hear that first of all.
If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world?
And, you know, in America, that Chasing Cars is a very big deal, as you know.
So I've heard tell.
First of all, I mean, what do you remember about that one, about writing it?
Well, that one was written in a very different environment. I did say earlier in our conversation that I hadn't written a song drunk, and that is not true, because now I remember what happened. Garrett, Jackknife Lee, and myself were in his... He now lives in Topanga in California. He, at the time, was living in Kent, which is, you know, an hour. I'll pronounce it in English rather than Northern Irish. An hour away from London. And in his old garage studio, him and I sat and we tanned, which is Northern Irish, Scots for drank. We tanned about three bottles of wine, and I wrote a about 10 songs that night, back when I had my elasticity. And one of those was Chasing Cars, but four other ones, so five songs actually of that, those 10 ended up on Eyes Open, which just went on to be our biggest selling record. To think of it now, it seems crazy to have written them all at the same time, but yeah, we listened back the next day with kind of the, you know, bleary eyed and also bracing against the possible you know, mess we were about to listen to. And Chasing Cars stood out like it hadn't stood out the night before, I think, in whatever fog it was written in. And that day it was like this beacon that, you know, choirs of angels or whatever were singing, and we realized we had something. And when I played to the rest of the guys, when I played to anybody, everybody went, this is big. Like everybody from the start, it was never a person that heard it that didn't go, fuck me, that's a big song. Which, you know, we'd been burned a lot of times before. We'd just had a hit record, but our first in 10 years. So we weren't in any way comfortable with where we were. We were still very much feeling like somebody's going to tap us on the shoulder and go, you're not supposed to be here. You have to leave this party. So we were mindful of not getting too excited about it. But all around us, people were getting excited about that song. And they were proven right. But, you know, I'm still not convinced it's a hit. I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna lie myself to feel like we've had hits, you know, because then you don't keep the foot on the accelerator.
See, even now in 2018, you're still not allowing this to enter your consciousness.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I think it's important to send the songs out into the world and then then let them be what they are out there and not think too much about what they mean to other people, because then you start to think about how you can write music that is going to affect people in the same way, and that is there be dragons. You know, you can't ever guess what people want to hear. You have to write what you want to hear. You have to actually probably take people out of the equation. That might seem like that's mean to our fans. I don't mean that to be so. I'm absolutely certain that our fans don't want to hear music that I think they want to hear. I think they want to hear music that's coming from our hearts. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Did you ever feel yourself falling into a trap of, I need a song for the radio on this, not this album, but in the past, like, especially when you were following up those hits, did you ever feel like, ugh, we don't have the hit, I need to think a little bit about the radio here? Did that ever creep into your mind?
No, it perhaps should have, but, because I think we went kind of the other way on the next album, after Eyes Open, 100 Million Suns, and I made an album very much for myself. That, you know, a lot of that came from the structure of the songs, the arrangements, pretty much everything came from demos that I'd made, you know, which is rare enough, you know, Garrett working from those rather than, you know, starting from scratch. And so that probably was a misstep, but it's probably the album that I love the most. Apart from Wildness, 100 Million Songs is the one I feel most connected to, but I don't think it connected with people as much as I would like.
Well, I hear a certain purity in Wildness. It does feel like you made something that's focused on reflecting your sort of artistic impulses and the way you're feeling about life and the world, and weren't thinking about radio or anything, it feels like.
No, we weren't. We didn't think about how it would live in the world at all. And we're only, when we came up for air, that's when you sort of go, okay, well, what song should be a single? You sort of retrofit things, you know, after you finished it.
Which song can have the trap remix?
Yeah, exactly. We had Mary from our management, from Q Prime, is here right now. And we had Peter Mensch and Cliff Bernstein, who run Q Prime, come and listen to the album. And they were the first people, the record company had heard it, but they were the first people after them that had heard the record. And we were really hopeful that they liked it. And they sat, I hope they don't mind me telling this story, I just think it's really funny. They sat in silence. In between songs, there was silence. There was no sound from them. At one point, I thought Cliff had fallen asleep. And then at the end, of us playing the record, which was pretty much the finished record at the time in order, the first words that Peter said was, "Okay, track one, track five, tracks." He knew every single song. He knew where, he knew what songs he wanted to be singles. He knew what songs were great. He knew lines from songs. He knew they were studying them. But it was terrifying. It was, the silence was absolutely terrifying. But it, like, it clearly profoundly affected them. And you know, I'm very grateful for that. That was the first kind of daunting experience of playing it to someone, and also a really profoundly happy experience in the end.
The silence of the management.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you've been listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. We were lucky enough to have Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol in the studio. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back next week here on Volume at 1 p.m. on Friday. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes if you feel like it. Thanks for listening.